Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Bobbi Jean Schweitzer, professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern University and an associate editor for Anesthesiology. And you are listening to an anesthesiology podcast designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in our journal. Today, we are speaking with two authors of publications that appear in the January 2019 issue of the journal. With us is Dr. Ashraf S. Habib. Dr. Habib is the lead author of an article titled, Amisulpride for the Rescue Treatment of Postoperative Nausea or Vomiting in Patients Failing Prophylaxis, a randomized placebo-controlled phase 3 trial. He is a professor in the Department of Anesthesiology, Duke University Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome, Dr. Habib.
Hello, Dr. Schweitzer. Thank you for having me.
And joining Dr. Habib is Dr. Jai Duvall, who wrote an accompanying editorial, Pounds of Prevention, but Only Ounces of Cure, The Need for More Research on the Treatment of Postoperative Nausea and Vomiting. Dr. Duvall is from the Department of Anesthesia and Pain Medicine, Royal Melbourne Hospital, Royal Melbourne Hospital Clinical School, and the Centre for Integrated Critical Care Medicine, all in Melbourne, Australia. Welcome, Dr. Duvall.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Schweitzer.
So first we'll start with you, Dr. Habib. Can you tell us what your primary goal or aim of this study was?
The primary goal of this study was to assess the efficacy and safety of intravenous amisulpride for the treatment of postoperative nausea and vomiting in patients who have already received prophylaxis but still developed postoperative nausea and vomiting. And the prophylaxis had to be with agents that work on other receptors other than those that amisulpride works on.
So I'm not sure how many of our listeners are familiar with amisulpride. Can you tell us a little bit more about this drug, maybe the mechanism of action, how it is administered, how fast does it work?
Amisulpride is actually an atypical antipsychotic that has been used internationally for more than 30 years. It's a substituted benzamide working as an antagonist at the dopaminergic receptors, the D2 and the D3 receptors. While the oral formulation is used for the antipsychotic effect in doses of 50 to 1200 milligrams per day, much lower doses in the order of 5 to 10 milligrams of an intravenous formulation are used for the management of postoperative nausea and vomiting. It has a rapid onset of action with the time to maximum plasma concentration being under 2 minutes.
And it's given as just an IV bolus push?
That's correct.
Is this drug available in the United States?
Not yet. It's currently undergoing FDA review, but might become available sometime in 2019.
Okay. So Dr. Duvall, how many people will fail optimal postoperative nausea and vomiting prophylaxis?
Well, it remains a problem. Prophylaxis is unfortunately not perfect, even with multiple drugs. Probably the best evidence in efficacy of prophylaxis comes from, it's a little old now, but the 2004 New England Journal paper by probably the doyen of postoperative nausea and vomiting, Apfel. So the impact paper, which you may remember, was the factorial study looking at a number of different drugs and the combination thereof in reducing the risk of postoperative nausea and vomiting. And there was a relative risk reduction of about 25% for each additional antiemetic prophylactic drug used, which is good, but not perfect, obviously. So what that means in practice is that really, as the authors state in that landmark paper, that the best that can be expected, even with total intravenous anesthesia in combination with three different class of antiemetic prophylactic drugs, is probably a 70% relative risk reduction. So what that means is that there will still be a proportion of patients, depending on risk profile, that will, despite best efforts, experience recurrent or failed prophylactic nausea and vomiting.
So it sounds like there was a need for this kind of study and for a drug that we can use.
The other, I guess, problem is that, you know, efficacy under trial conditions doesn't always translate to real-world effectiveness, and that's very evident in the case of prophylaxis for nausea and vomiting. So despite, you know, well-promulgated guidelines and I think probably certainly in the Australasian community, good knowledge base about the best drugs to use and when to use them, we know from the evidence that this doesn't translate well into optimal prophylaxis for our patients. Compliance with guidelines probably sits at best around 30 to 50% if you look at the literature. So there's definitely a role for improving our prophylaxis of patients as well. What this means is that there will always be a role for good rescue medication.
Yes, it does seem like we still struggle with this issue. So, Dr. Beebe, did you evaluate just one dose of amisulpride? And what drug or drugs did you use as a comparison or to compare amisulpride against?
So we actually evaluated two doses of amisulpride in this study, a 5-milligram dose and a 10-milligram dose. The 5-milligram dose was the one that was shown in prior study to be the optimal dose for prophylaxis. And we hypothesized that a higher dose might be needed for treatment in those patients who have received prior prophylaxis and failed. Therefore, we decided to include the two doses of amisulpride, the 5-milligram dose and the 10-milligram dose. And with regards to the comparison, this was actually a placebo-controlled trial. So amisulpride was compared to placebo, not to an active drug, the study.
Were patients randomized and blinded?
Correct. So patients who have received prior prophylaxis and who developed PONV in the PACU were randomized to receive the 5-milligram dose, the 10-milligram dose, or a placebo. And then there was a 30-minute evaluation for postoperative nausea and vomiting. Initially, during this time, if the patients requested any further treatment, they could have further treatment, but usually it was discouraged to have treatment prior to 30 minutes to allow the study drug to have its effect, but the patients could still request rescue treatment during this time, or if the provider deemed that it was necessary to provide further treatment during this time, it was done so. And interestingly, this was in the protocol, but eventually no patients received extra doses during this 30-minute time period.
And was this a single-center study, and how many patients did you enroll?
No, this was actually a multi-center study that enrolled over 700 patients, and it was conducted in 23 centers in the United States, in Canada, as well as in Europe.
Quite a broad swath of patients. Can you tell us a little bit more about the population that were enrolled, what type of surgeries they had, that sort of thing?
So the study enrolled adult patients who were undergoing a wide range of surgeries, either open or laparoscopic elective surgery that was expected to last at least 1 hour. Those patients had to receive general anesthesia with inhaled agents, and they were deemed to be at moderate or high risk for experiencing postoperative nausea and vomiting. They should have received prophylaxis for postoperative nausea and vomiting using antiemetics from classes other than the dopaminergic antagonist, which is the dopaminergic antagonist.
So Dr. Duvall, Dr. Habib mentioned about patients had to be at moderate to high risk for nausea and vomiting. Can you review for us the typical risk factors for post-op nausea and vomiting and how a patient would be determined moderate to high risk?
Sure. So anesthesiologists would be well aware and familiar with the APFOL scoring system, which is a really neat bedside four-point scale, looking at the factors that add about a 20% baseline risk to a patient's risk of nausea and vomiting. So that's being a female gender, a non-smoker, a past history of motion sickness, or indeed post-operative nausea and vomiting, and the use of post-operative opioids. This is a really neat bedside tool to help determine a risk profile with patients with two or more risk factors considered at moderate or high risk. More recently, the same group, APFOL's group, has conducted an updated meta-analysis looking at indeed these factors, and they're probably not all as equal as each other. So female gender is probably the strongest patient-specific predictor, with an increased odds ratio of probably about 2.5 times compared to male patients. A history of post-operative nausea and vomiting would be next, and then a history of non-smoking status. There are, of course, some other more minor predictors which add risk, and that might include the usage of nitrous oxide. Operation type is still debated. Gynecological surgery, cholecystectomies, laparoscopic surgery seeming to be of increased risk as well. Whether this is just because female gender patients tend to have these operations more commonly, it's not known. The contribution of intraoperative opioids is probably weaker than first thought, but certainly adds some risk. So, yeah, there's a wide range of risk factors that contribute, but it's useful to be able to calculate that risk score preoperatively to identify those moderate to high-risk patients.
So you mentioned nitrous oxide. I still hear this debated quite a bit. Is it like if you use nitrous oxide for more than a certain amount of time, any exposure to nitrous oxide, how important is that risk factor?
It's a good question, Dr. Schweitzer. It's probably not well teased out, the duration question in particular, because of significant heterogeneity in individual studies. Again, that updated meta-analysis in the British Journal of Anaesthesia in 2012 by Apfel's group looked at this question. It does contribute, probably does have a duration or dose response effect, but it is a weak predictor. I think the odds ratio there was calculated at 1.45. So, you know, not nearly the risk imparted by being female or having a past history, but it would be considered a minor predictor of postoperative nausea and vomiting.
Dr. Beebe, were these the kinds of risk factors that you use to stratify your patients and select them?
Yeah, so we selected patients who were deemed to be at moderate or high risk for experiencing postoperative nausea and vomiting according to the AFI risk score, according to these four risk factors that Dr. Duval just mentioned, female gender, history of PONV or motion sickness, non-smokers, and use of postoperative opioids. So 51% of patients we included in the study had four risk factors, meaning that they had about 80% risk for developing PONV according to the APFIL score. And 43% of those patients had three risk factors, meaning that they were considered to have about 60% risk for developing postoperative nausea and vomiting according to the APFIL score.
And what were the typical prophylactic drugs that the study patients received, and what percentage of them got one versus two or even three drugs?
So the most commonly used antiemetics in the study were ondansetrone and dexamethasone, which is similar to current practice. A few patients received granisetrone, scopolamine, or other antiemetics, and in general, 50% of patients in the study received one agent, 42% received two agents, and 7% received three or more prophylactic antiemetics.
So, Dr. Duval, can you tell us what we already know regarding which drugs are effective for treatment versus prevention of PONV?
Sure. So, similar classes of drugs are useful for both, and that's the first thing to say, I guess, and that's useful for us as anesthesiologists. We don't have to think too carefully about it. For prophylaxis, the typical classes of drugs that would be used would be the 5-HT3 receptor antagonists, such as the Citrons, corticosteroids, so dexamethasone, anti-dopaminergic drugs, such as amisulpride, but more long-standing use drugs would be droperidol, haloperidol, antihistamines, anticholinergics, with some weak evidence for other classes of drugs, gabapentinoids, alpha-2 antagonists, that sort of thing. The classes of drugs seem to be equal in efficacy. So, again, going back to that IMPACT New England Journal paper in 2004, the doses and drugs used there, ondansetron 4 milligrams, droperidol 1.25 milligrams, dexamethasone 4 milligrams, for prophylaxis were all equally effective, as I mentioned before, reducing the risk of PONV by about 25%. A similar effect is seen with propofol as a total intravenous anesthetic technique. For treatment, the first thing to say, I guess, is that an antiemetic from a different pharmacological class should be used from that's failed for prophylaxis. So that's been well shown in the literature. In terms of the 5-HT3 antagonists, doses are smaller. So on ondansetron, perhaps only 1 milligram versus 4 to 8 for prophylaxis. And again, the other classes of drugs are equally effective for PONV. So dexamethasone, droperidol, promethazine. The antiemetic effect with low doses of propofol is certainly seen, but is probably brief when used as a rescue treatment. And of course, there is emerging interest and evidence for alternative treatments for rescue treatment of nausea and vomiting as well.
Such as?
So there's some evidence for isopropyl alcohol inhalation, so that's an emerging area. Anesthesiologists would be familiar with acupuncture and acupressure, which has a fairly robust evidence base now, although hasn't been taken up widely, I think in part because of the need for training and knowledge base around its use is not great. Our clinical trials network in Australia and New Zealand is studying chewing gum as a rescue treatment for nausea and vomiting, which has been shown to be of some early benefit in a pilot randomised controlled trial. And we're currently conducting a large multi-centre, multinational randomised controlled trial looking at chewing gum versus ondansetron as a rescue treatment for established nausea and vomiting after surgery.
So interesting stuff, and maybe soon we're going to find out whether amisulpride is also an emerging treatment. But before we get to the results of this study, I want to ask Dr. Beebe another question. So, you know, I was struck by the fact that in spite of these patients being sort of moderate to high risk for nausea and vomiting, 50% of them received only one prophylactic drug. And I thought it was sort of recommended that for each risk factor, one should give a drug. Was this a real-world kind of case where you just allowed the anesthesiologist to do their own prophylaxis and then you guys were just coming in with the rescue evaluation, or did you try to encourage or were they given guidelines around prophylaxis?
So in the study, the prophylaxis really was left at the discretion of the anesthesiologist at each participating center. The only guidance for this trial was that prophylactic agents to be used should be from a different pharmacologic class than antidopaminergic drugs. Mm-hmm. And as we discussed earlier on, the study really was a multi-center, multinational study where numerous centers in different countries have participated, and maybe the practice really varies in these different centers as far as prophylaxis. And I agree with your comments. Currently, there are two approaches that are recommended for PONV prophylaxis, either a risk-adapted approach where you personalize prophylaxis based on the number of risk factors that the patient has, and an easy recipe for this is giving one agent for each risk factor, or a second approach is using universal multimodal approach where you use a combination of antiemetics to all patients irrespective of risk factors, and this has to do somehow with the poor compliance of providers with guidelines that we discussed earlier on in this podcast.
Yeah, I'm still very puzzled by why the best evidence doesn't somehow get translated to clinical practice. So, the moment we've been waiting for, tell us what you found from your study.
So what we found from our study, we found that the 10 milligram dose of amisulpride was superior to placebo at treating established PONV in those patients who have failed prophylaxis, whereas the 5 milligram dose was not superior to placebo. So the 5 milligram dose was the one that was shown to be the optimal dose for prophylaxis. But interestingly, in this treatment study, the 10 milligram dose was the only dose that was found to be effective.
So I guess that was very wise of you to appreciate that maybe you were going to need a larger dose and study that.
I mean, I think this was discussed at the study design stage, and I guess at the end we were happy that we decided to include both doses, the 5 milligrams and the 10 milligram dose, since the 5 milligram dose actually did not show to be effective.
Dr. Duvall, I recall that almost 50% of the patients in this study who received the placebo had a complete response at 2 hours. Do you think this was because the PONV just resolved on its own over time, or that placebo is pretty darn good?
That's a good question, Dr. Schweitzer. We know that there's a strong placebo effect for many medications in trials, but no. Certainly, amisulpride works. I suppose one thing to say about nausea and vomiting is that it does resolve over time. And so regardless of a placebo effect or even just not treating nausea or vomiting, a proportion will get better. But it's not high. So we know this from historical studies. It's hard these days to do placebo-controlled trials in nausea and vomiting, but there was a number of studies conducted in the 1980s and 1990s, which there's a nice systematic review of 28 such trials done by Eberhard in BMC Anesthesiology in the early 2000s, pooling data from these 28 trials, looking at how good placebo is for established nausea and vomiting. They found a pooled incidence of a recurrence rate of about 70%. Really, if you don't treat your patients with nausea or vomiting, only about 30% will get better, which interestingly, and it aligns very nicely with the placebo incident rate in Dr. Habib's study, which I think was about 72%. Certainly, there is some effect from placebo or even no treatment with natural resolution, and I think all of us that have experienced an episode of vomiting would know that it does make you feel better. But amisulpride certainly a lot better than placebo in this study.
So, Dr. Habib, does this drug have any common side effects? And did you see any problems in the population that you studied?
We didn't actually see any problems in our patients as far as side effects. There was no difference in side effects between the amisulpride group and the placebo groups. And this being an anticholinergic drug, obviously you worry about extrapyramidal side effects, which we did not see in this study or in prior PONV studies investigating amisulpride. There was no increase in sedation or cardiac events. The only side effect that is known to occur with amisulpride is actually an increase in serum prolactin as a result of prolactin release from the anterior pituitary. It's not really clear whether this is of any clinical significance, though.
I believe this drug is very similar to droperidol, right, which carries a black box warning regarding a risk of QT prolongation. And I know that's a very debatable issue, but is this a concern with amisulpride?
So that's a good question. Obviously, prolongation of the QT interval occurs with D2 antagonists in general because they bind to the hERG potassium channels in the heart. Droperidol exhibits a high affinity for such channels, but the binding affinity of amisulpride to those channels actually has been shown to be more than a thousandfold lower than that of droperidol in vitro testing. And if we look at the PONV studies that investigated amisulpride, there was no difference between amisulpride and placebo with regards to QT prolongation. However, amisulpride does exhibit dose-related prolongation of the QT interval. And there is a nice pharmacokinetic study that involved 40 volunteers that looked at doses of amisulpride from 5 milligram to 40 milligram. What the study revealed that anti-emetic doses of amisulpride did not lead to prolongation of the QT interval above the threshold that's considered to be of concern by the FDA.
Dr. Duvall, you mentioned, I think, about how perhaps challenging it is to do placebo-controlled trials today for nausea and vomiting, even though these have been done in the past. And I was a bit surprised when I recall seeing in the speech balloon of your editorial the statement, there is a lack of high-quality randomized controlled trials of postoperative nausea and vomiting treatment with or without preceding prophylaxis. Because postoperative nausea and vomiting is so common, I would think this problem would have been extensively studied. And I think there has been quite a bit of study of the prophylaxis of nausea and vomiting. Why hasn't treatment been studied more?
That's an excellent question, Dr. Schweitzer. And I think it's a real shame that there hasn't been more study in this area. And Dr. Habib and colleagues are to be congratulated for doing what is a hard study to do. Particularly considering the economics of scale, I think the latest World Health Organization estimates are that there's about 300 million surgical procedures conducted around the world annually. That's a lot of vomiting patients despite best prophylaxis. So it does raise the question, why haven't there been as much study of rescue treatment? I think the reasons are probably multifactorial. Drug companies are likely to look at economics of scale because prophylaxis is administered to many more patients than true rescue treatment would be. Clinical trials for prophylaxis may indeed prove more cost-effective and more lucrative for study. In addition, there's obviously the need to enrol many more patients for a study into treatment effects. So if we look at an incident rate or a failed prophylaxis rate of, say, 30%, then that's 70% of patients enrolled that won't ultimately go on to be randomised if indeed we're studying a rescue treatment. I think as well there's complexity in designing a trial of rescue treatment, and that complexity is with regards to the semantics, nausea, do you measure it on an ordinal scale, is it binary, vomiting, retching, do you look at that, what time points do you look at, so do we consider any nausea, vomiting or retching in a 2-hour period, which some studies look at, a 24-hour period. So that makes it quite difficult to standardise rescue treatments or study of rescue treatments, whereas failure of prophylaxis is a lot simpler in many ways.
So Dr. Habib, I think you discussed in your paper, and I know you both have mentioned it in this interview, that one needs to be sure that they provide a treatment drug from a class that is different than drugs used for prophylaxis. And yet I seem to see it's quite common for providers to do repeat doses of particularly 5-HT3 antagonists such as ondansetron. Do you think this is due to ignorance or a lack of good alternative drugs for treatment of post-op nausea and vomiting?
This is a very interesting question. I think originally this repeat dosing of ondansetron might have been due to the lack of knowledge about the limited efficacy of this repeat dosing. But back in, I think, in the 1990s, Dr. Kovac did an excellent study where he showed that repeat dosing of ondansetron is no better than placebo in treating PONV in patients who have previously received ondansetron. So we have known for a long time that a repeat dosing of ondansetron is not effective, and all the guidelines state that. However, providers like ondansetron, mainly because of its favorable side effect and, in particular, lack of sedation. So I believe currently the practice of repeat dosing of ondansetron is largely due to the lack of antiemetic agents from other classes that are proven to be effective and that have a good side effect profile when used for rescue. In particular, lack of side effects such as sedation or extrapyramidal side effects are important when choosing an antiemetic for treating PONV in the PACU when you need an effective agent to treat PONV without side effects that might lead to prolongation of PACU stay.
So maybe we're finally going to get that drug if misoprostol gets approved. Dr. Beeb, do you have a take-home message for our listeners who encounter a patient perhaps today, though it's getting kind of late unless they're on call, or tomorrow, or this week, who is nauseated or vomiting in the PACU after having already received maximum prophylaxis? Because after listening to this podcast, they're going to start doing, you know, optimal prophylaxis. But let's say they've already received ondansetron or another 5-HT3 antagonist, like we know is quite common, and dexamethasone intraoperatively for prophylaxis of post-op nausea and vomiting. How would you or what would you recommend today, since we don't have a misoprostol, that they manage that patient?
So as we mentioned, we need to use an antiemetic that's from a different pharmacologic class and that has a rapid onset of action, which excludes some agents that are effective for prophylaxis but takes some time to exert an antiemetic effect, such as scopolamine, for instance. So unfortunately, we don't have a lot of great options currently available. But until an agent such as amisulpride might become available, which our study suggested would be a good option, meanwhile, in my practice, I currently use low-dose promethazine or metoclopramide or haloperidol for rescue treatment of PONV in PACU.
And Dr. Duvall, since you're in Australia, first off, is amisulpride available to you? And secondly, do you have anything to add to Dr. Habib's formula?
As far as I know, it's not at this stage available to us in Australasia. So we keenly await the regulatory approvals that you mentioned might be coming in the next year or so. We have a very similar setup. I think one of the nice things about anesthesiology around the world, particularly with respect to post-operative nausea and vomiting, is that it's very multinational. I think we have access to all the same drugs. I would use a similar regimen. Metoclopramide I don't use as much in my practice. the more recent evidence suggests it's probably got weaker antiemetic effects than first thought, and the doses required are much higher than the 10 milligrams that certainly I learnt growing up. Probably 25 to 50 milligrams would be the antiemetic dose, but of course then the side effect profile becomes considerable. I use a lot of droperidol as a prophylactic drug, trying to reserve citrons more for rescue in my practice. And dexamethasone is used a lot in Australasia. There are, of course, some concerns about effects on wound infection and other side effects, and currently we're conducting the PADI trial looking at that question with intravenous dexamethasone for prophylaxis. But, yeah, I think, as Dr. Habib has said, one of the big challenges is to use different classes of drugs for rescue, and that's something that can be hard when you've already administered much of your armamentarium as prophylaxis to a high-risk patient.
Mm-hmm. I hope today's discussion will interest many of our listeners and lead you to read this important article to learn more. Thank you, Drs. Habib and Duvall, for discussing your work with us today. I wish you well as you continue your efforts to enhance the practice of anesthesiology and strive to improve the care of our patients.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.